Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Benall of BenallOfAmerica.com with another edition of Benall of America Audio Season 2. It is November 18th, 2006, and we are back after our week off last week and the big trip to Las Vegas for the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference 4. I have so much to say about the conference, but we're going to save all that for the end of the program because we have an amazing interview on tap for you this week. The guest is Peter Davenport, director of the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter Davenport has been the director there for over a decade, so he's got his finger on the pulse of what's going on today as far as UFO sightings are concerned. And what I like about our conversation this week is that usually when you hear Peter Davenport on the radio, he is discussing contemporary cases. He's got a couple witnesses on with him, and they're talking about a UFO sighting that took place, you know, in the last couple of months. For this interview, it's just pure Peter Davenport, and we're talking about the National UFO Reporting Center, how he came upon the job, the trends and changes he's observed at the center since he took over, and just overall, we're really going to dig into the details of the National UFO Reporting Center. Additionally, we're going to be discussing ufology, UFOs in the media, the government's role in the UFO phenomenon. I throw the classic chestnut of give me your best cases, and Peter talks about a handful of seriously good UFO cases that he's collected at the National UFO Reporting Center during his tenure. And we're going to talk about the Todd Sees case that many people in ufology have been talking about for quite some time. We're going to discuss that in depth as Peter was one of the very first people on that story. And as is the case here at Benall of America Audio, tons and tons more. I've wanted to interview Peter for the show for a long time, so when we finally got a chance to sit down for our conversation, I already had a ton of questions for him, and we just cover a lot of ground here in this interview. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Peter Davenport, let me give you a little bit of background on him. Peter Davenport is the director of the National UFO Reporting Center, and he has been since July of 1994. He was born in St. Louis, Missouri, where he lived to the age of 14. As a boy, he attended high school in St. Louis, Ethiopia, and New Hampshire. He received his undergraduate education at Stanford University in California, where he earned bachelor's degrees in both Russian and biology, and a translator's certificate in Russian. His graduate education was completed at the University of Washington in Seattle, where he earned an MS degree in genetics and biochemistry of fish from the College of Fisheries, as well as an MBA degree in finance and international business from the Graduate School of Business. He has had an active interest in the UFO phenomenon from his early boyhood. He experienced his first UFO sighting over the St. Louis Municipal Airport in the summer of 1954, and he investigated his first UFO case during the summer of 1965 in Exeter, New Hampshire. He has been witness to several anomalous events, possibly UFO-related, including a dramatic sighting over Baja, California in February 1990, and several nighttime sightings over Washington State during 1992. In addition to being the director of the National UFO Reporting Center, Peter is a current member of MUFON and is a former co-state section director and former director of investigation for the Washington State chapter of MUFON. You can find out more information about Peter Davenport and the National UFO Reporting Center at www.ufocenter.com. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was recorded on August 23rd, 2006. Peter Davenport on Benall of America Audio, Season 2. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Benall of America Audio. I want to welcome as my special guest this week, Peter Davenport. He is the director of the National UFO Reporting Center. He's been investigating the UFO phenomenon since 1965, so he's got 40-plus years in the field. He's done a tremendous amount of work for the field of ufology, and it's just a great pleasure to have him on the show. As I said, he's the director of the National UFO Reporting Center. That's the hotline where they take calls of UFO reports from people all over the country and presumably all over the world. We'll find that out. And you can find more information about the National UFO Reporting Center at www.nuforc.org or ufocenter.com. Peter Davenport, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tim. I'm delighted to be here. I'm looking forward to this one.
Awesome. I'm really excited about talking to you. I've been trying to get you on the show for a while now, so I'm brimming with questions and really looking forward to it.
Good.
Let's start out with your background, your bio, how you came to become interested in the UFO phenomenon and sort of how your experience as a researcher evolved.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm correct in saying that my first experience with UFOs was at the age of six.
Wow.
This was July of 1954. I was sitting at a drive-in theater in St. Louis, right on the southern edge of the St. Louis Airport, Lambert Field, and I, together with my family members and no doubt hundreds and hundreds of other people, were witness to one of the most dramatic UFO events I've ever heard about. It was a brilliantly bright red object about the color of a red traffic signal, as big as a full moon in the night sky. It was oval in shape, and it was giving off bright red light that illuminated the area for quite a distance around us. And people were getting out of their cars at the drive-in theater, ignoring the movie, and staring up in the night sky at this object. That was my first experience, so far as I'm aware, with a UFO, or UFO sighting, I presume, or is a better way to put it. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I've been interested in UFOs, perhaps since that event, but certainly since the 1960s, when I was a teenager. I would read everything I could lay my hands on. Then, in 1965, shortly after I had graduated from high school up in New Hampshire, we had a very dramatic event that involved a number of people, but principally two police officers from Exeter, New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and an 18-year-old hitchhiker. His name was Muscarello, I happen to remember, allegedly had a very dramatic sighting. In fact, there was a series of sightings that night in the vicinity of Exeter, New Hampshire. And I was working for the local town newspaper, the Derry News. Derry, New Hampshire was where I lived. Many people may recognize that. That was, residence of Alan Shepard, our first astronaut in space, grew up in East Derry, New Hampshire. And also, it was the home of Robert Frost, the celebrated poet, mm-hmm. who taught high school in Derry, New Hampshire. But I was assigned by my newspaper to go up to Exeter and do a story on this event in September of 1965. It occurred on the 3rd of September. I investigated within a matter of days and published an article in our local newspaper on what happened up there. I didn't know it at the time, but that case was to become a celebrated case,
yeah.
Known as the incident at Exeter. So, you're right, my experience as an investigator goes back to 1965, 41 years, and I've been intrigued by the subject ever since.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like it. Now, how did you, like I was saying to you when we were trying to set up the interview, I've heard you on countless occasions on the Jeff Renz Show, Coast to Coast AM, talking about cases that you have that have come up in recent months and what have you when you're on their shows. But what I had never really heard is how you came to take over the National UFO Reporting Center. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's historically important, I think, to the field of ufology, and it's sort of fallen between the cracks as you're continuing to do your work. You know, we gotta look back and fill that gap in, I think.
Yeah, well, I commend you for your interest in fine detail like that, because that's the type of thing you have to do to investigate or explain any phenomenon. But I think I can answer your question with two words: sheer misfortune. back in July of 1994, mm-hmm. I was on the telephone one Friday night with a friend, and at the end of our conversation, he said, "Oh, by the way, did you know that Bob Gribble, the gentleman who founded the National UFO Reporting Center back in October of 1974,
yeah.
did you know that Bob Gribble is considering shutting down the hotline? He had run it for 20 years at that point, and I suspect he was just exhausted by it, if his experience has been or was anything like mine."
Yeah.
Well, I made the mistake of calling Bob. I knew him. I had known him for 3 years or more at that point, and I said, "You know, Bob, I've applied to you to work as a volunteer on the hotline, and you've not accepted my volunteer services, but that is a job that I would consider doing." And he said instantly, "Peter, it's yours."
Wow.
And I should have known better than to accept it. I should have turned my back on it and walked away, because it has completely re-engineered my life from what it was at the time and what it probably would have become over the last 12 years that I've been doing this job. But it was just about, in fact, it was the 26th of August, 1994. So I'm coming up on 2 days from now will be Saturday, the 26th of August. That'll be the 12th anniversary of my taking over the hotline.
Wow.
And it has been a fascinating experience. It's completely changed my view of what reality may be. I'm not sure I have a better handle on what reality is, but it's changed my view of what reality might be if we had enough information to explain those things that are taking place around us that remain a mystery.
And now, what do you say changed your view of reality? Is that just because you got sort of sheer number of different types of cases that you were like, there's so much more to this than I thought? Is that sort of thing?
No. Well, I believe by 1994, I was well versed in, for example, the crop formation phenomenon, which I think is UFO related. I was aware of the abduction phenomenon, of course. I was aware of the animal mutilation phenomenon and all of these things. But what I think I was not aware of, or not as aware of as I am today, I believe, is how extensive all of these events, all of these phenomena may be in our lives, and how frequently they may occur on our planet. And that's the one thing that taking 20, 30, or 40 reports per day can do to a person, because it alerts him or her to what is going on around us, and which, were it not for programs precisely like this one, the American people would not be aware of. Clearly, their government seems to want to keep them in the dark with regard to the phenomenon of UFOs. And again, that underscores the value of your program and this interview and the many, many other people who are engaged in serious investigation into the UFO phenomenon.
Oh, well, thanks. Over the course of the 12 years you've been doing the hotline, have you noticed any sort of trends as far as when, first of all, like when you get the reports? Is there a peak time of day, peak time of year, or sort of any sort of trend as far as like the people that are making the reports?
Yeah. People ask me questions like that, questions about the statistics of UFO sightings, UFO reports, et cetera, et cetera. And I think probably the most accurate answer is I have not seen any trends that I think are worth even mentioning.
Wow.
Now, we have looked at our data with regard to nighttime or versus daytime sightings, and it appears that about 55 or 60%, I think it was, of all the reports we have on file were of sightings after daylight hours, that is, during darkness.
Yeah.
But that's no great surprise, given that oftentimes these things we call UFOs are seen to give off light, in some instances very, very bright light. We can talk about one of those cases later. And so I think it would be expected that people would be apt to see them most frequently at night because of the difference or the contrast between the brightness of the light and the dark background of the night sky.
Yeah.
But that's pure conjecture on my part. I think the only real, really substantial answer to your question is one can see UFOs at any time of day or night. And people do. That's evident from our website, where people report these sightings.
And now the website's up and running, and it's been up for a while and everything. Have you found a lot of people are sort of reporting cases that they hadn't reported, like in the previous 10, 20 years? And, like I'm trying to say, is like, let's say somebody had a sighting in 1973 or something. Now they're coming to the website to report that because they hadn't known or had a place to report it back then when it first happened.
That's a very good question, Tim. Yes, you're exactly correct. Because of programs like this and the many, many other television and radio programs and public appearances I have had over the last 12 years, I have been moderately, and I say only moderately, successful in getting people to report their past sightings. People call me all the time saying, gee, I've been listening to you for 10 years on the radio. Do you want me to submit my report of the six aliens we saw walk through our apartment on such and such a date? And I say, absolutely. first of all, why did you not report it immediately?
Yeah.
And secondly, why do you want somebody to give you permission to report it?
Yeah.
It is very frustrating to me. I have to be honest with you, I'm more than a little disappointed in some of the American people in the sense that so many of them seem to need approval or permission to do such and such. My clear message to everybody who is listening to us at this moment is if you have ever in your lifetime, or if any of your family members ever in their lifetimes have seen what they sincerely believe was a UFO, be sure to write that information down, because it is preciously important to get those reports recorded in written form. People call me up all the time. They want to talk about their report. I want them not to talk about it. That's like racing your engine at a red stoplight.
Yeah.
I want them to write down the details of their sighting. A written report is worth 1,000 times more, maybe 10,000 times more than an oral report. And yet trying to get people to write these things down is almost impossible. I don't know why that is.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, why do you think that is? And one of the important things about the UFO reporting center is that you guys do you take the anonymous reports, you try to keep it as anonymous as possible. That should really help people to make the reports. A lot of people are scared to do something like that, you know?
Absolutely. First of all, I don't know why Americans should be scared of anything. But they are. You're absolutely correct. People will call up and say, are you part of the government? I don't want to have anything to do with them. Or maybe they'll come and knock on my doors, and I say, who's they?
Yeah.
Who's going to knock on your door? Well, it could be the FBI, or it does get to me. It has begun to get to me after 12 years of this. My response to those people is stand up, stiffen your spine, stand up straight, and speak your piece. Let your neighbors, your fellow countrymen, most of all, let your government know what you have seen, mm-hmm. and say it loudly and clearly and grammatically correctly so other people can understand what it was that you experienced. Until we get the American people accustomed to doing that, we're going to have trouble not only in ufology, but in every other field of endeavor in this country, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Now, this question sort of is born out of my own personal experience, because just a little background. I had at work one night, a friend of mine had said he'd seen a UFO earlier in the night, and I was asking him sort of to elaborate on it, and so I could try and find out more information about it. And so that sort of led me to this question, because after I was talking to him, I was sort of thinking to myself, you know, I really don't even know the right questions to ask him. So what's like the most important data to collect if one witnesses a UFO? What should they keep in mind that they should definitely want to make note of?
Well, generally, what the person should do is, first of all, sit down and write down everything they can remember about their sighting, what the time and date were. That's very important. Mm-hmm. People are calling me all the time and saying, well, I think I had a UFO sighting, but I don't remember if it was in the 90s or the 60s. Was it April, or maybe it was November? Well, the problem there is what we like to do is get those reports so we can compare that report with another report that it may have occurred somewhere else in the country or the world,
yeah,
on the same date at about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't do that if the times are not accurate. So the most important data point, in my opinion, is the time and date of an occurrence. A lot of people, particularly journalists, reporters, will call up and say, have there been any sightings in our little town right here, just up to Birch Street? Well, my response to them is, it's unimportant whether there were other sightings in your community. What is most important is whether there were any other sightings anywhere in the country or the world at about the same time, on the same date. And I say that because it appears to me that these objects that we've called UFOs for now just over 59 years are capable of traveling at dramatically rapid velocities,
yeah,
thousands or tens or hundreds of thousands of miles an hour. unimaginable speeds, velocities, relative to our technology. So they can be here 1 minute and perhaps be in Japan 5 minutes later.
Yeah.
So it is the temporal comparison rather than the geographic comparison that is so important. And yet all journalists fail to observe that fact. So getting back to your question, the most important subjects are the time, the date, and just a rational, hopefully grammatically correct statement of fact about what the witness has seen. And equally important is independent reports from other witnesses who may have seen the same incident. And I say independent because you don't want people to get together and collaborate over coffee,
yeah,
over what they see, what they have seen. What you want all of the witnesses to do, ideally, is sit down and each person writes independently of all of the other witnesses what he or she saw so that the reports can be compared with one another. They are independent reports. The value of this we've seen on many occasions because the different people who are witness to the same event will oftentimes see and remember and report different elements of the event. And what you want to do is get all of that information from all of the witnesses. That's our objective.
Yeah. And now as far as now we sort of talked about trends as far as calls that come in. Now what about trends developing over the course of your tenure with regards to the advancement of technology? I mean,
yeah,
people, it seems like everybody has a cell phone now, which should make it easier for them to call in a case pretty easily, especially if they're right there.
Yeah.
And also, a lot of these cameras have, a lot of these phones have cameras on them, and that's a really new advancement in the last couple of years. You would think,
yeah,
that would produce a lot of new UFO video or pictures.
Yeah.
Have you noticed any sort of trend developing in that where the reports are getting better as a result of that?
Yeah, good question. And what I can say in response is, yes, some technology helps, but there's also a downside to it.
Yeah.
For example, the first big boon to ufology was the telephone and people's ability to call somebody and report what they saw. They don't have to travel 3,000 miles to report their sighting to the National UFO Reporting Center.
Yeah.
Although phones have been around for a long time, since the 20s or 30s. The next big advancement, I would say, was the internet. Suddenly, people could report their sightings not just over the telephone orally, but in written form. And as I've already discussed, a written report is vastly superior to an oral report.
Yeah.
So the internet was a great boon to ufology, and not only to witnesses to UFO events, but to the investigators themselves, because suddenly the investigators can post their information, mm-hmm, giving access to it to almost anybody who's on the internet. And also, investigators can hand information back and forth. This has happened only since the advent of the internet or its availability to the common man. Now, you mentioned the cell phone, and you're exactly correct. Ideally, in an ideal world that runs just perfectly, the cell phone would be a boon to ufology, just as the internet has been.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it turns out to be quite something else, something different, because what the cell phone, I think the cell phone has re-engineered, to a large degree, re-engineered our culture, because whereas when I was a kid back in the 50s, in order to make a long-distance call, you had to do it from the telephone that sat in the hallway of your family home within earshot of your parents.
Yeah.
Well, today, how many kids have cell phones? It must be in the tens of millions.
Yeah.
And they are out of earshot of parental supervision and guidance, so they can do and say anything they want. And, in fact, that has been, it has been the bane of my life over the last year, because whereas, say, 5 or 10 years ago, maybe 5% of the calls coming into the hotline were hoax calls,
mm-hmm,
today it ranges between 50 and 90% of,
wow,
the calls I receive are hoaxes being placed by young kids or teenagers or college kids with their cell phones And during many of those reports or phone calls, they just yell obscenities, the most triple X rated obscenities I've ever heard in my life. And it is threatening to cause me to shut down the hotline. I just cannot do this anymore. And I may just shift to internet only. If people want to submit reports, they must be in written form, and they must be submitted using our online report form.
Yeah, that's a shame. That's really just too bad. It makes me angry, to be honest with you.
It makes me more than angry, and it's probably a good thing that these people are not known to me personally, because I would try to solve the problem in a personal fashion.
And what do you think, aside from teenage hijinks, you know, let's not even go there. Let's not even discuss that, because I don't want to even waste time on them. But let's talk about people who are hoaxing the calls, the hoax calls. You know what I mean?
Yes.
What do you think is to blame for those people that are hoaxing, that are producing the hoaxes, and not just the hoax calls and the hoax reports, but also these hoax videos like that recent Australian one that came out?
I compliment you for the question, because that's a very important question from my vantage point. And hosts and newspaper reporters seldom ask that question. But it is a very, very interesting phenomenon, in my opinion. It is an interesting statement about a significant majority of, or a significant fraction, I should say, of the American population. People calling and essentially lying about what they allegedly saw, but in point of fact, they didn't.
Yeah.
Why do people do that? It is a mystery to me, but you're right. That's a very significant issue, why people would do that. And in fact, any UFO investigator is confronted with that, the reality of that tragic situation. They have to weed out that which is true from that which is not. Because if you start basing your decisions on information that is not true, which is hoaxed, then you have a really unsavory situation, because you could be led down a path that is falsely created. However, let me say that it is quite possible, in most cases, I feel, I am able to detect most hoaxes, I think. Most cases that are not true, most citing reports that are not true, and people may say, well, that's not possible. Well, if they had taken as many UFO reports over the telephone as I have taken, I suspect they would be of a different opinion. Because there are many, I find, parameters, there are many characteristics of a false report that I have come to recognize that are very useful flags with regard to every report. So I feel that I'm pretty successful at weeding out most of the false reports. And I used to say that probably 70% of the reports that came to our center were not of genuine UFOs. Today, I think it's probably closer to 90%.
Wow.
And although I nevertheless post some of those reports that are cases of mistaken identity or out-and-out hoax, just to let the readers at our website know that I am sensitive to this type of case and that I'm alert to them, and I'm trying to weed them out to the best of my ability.
Yeah. Now, when you get somebody that calls up and they're trying to sell you on a bogus UFO story, at what point do you sort of pull the plug on that? Do you let them know right away, or do you sort of humor them and then just after they're off the phone, you know, just toss it in the waste bin?
You have very good insight into this field, Tim. I compliment you.
Thank you.
My response to calls like that is variable. It depends on my mood and my attitude, frankly. If I'm in a persnickety mood, I could yell at them. I could hang up on them precipitously. Or in some cases, I'll toy with them. I remember one call in point of fact. This was a very interesting call. You may have heard of the celebrated Phoenix Lights case.
Yeah.
That occurred over Phoenix Thursday night, March 13th, 1997. Well, a couple of years after that event had occurred, a young man called me up and he said, he asked me if I knew what the real cause of the Phoenix Lights event was, which he certainly knew, and I assured him that I didn't know what it was, but I didn't think that the objects that were reported, had been reported, were of terrestrial origin. He said, oh, yes, they were. They were U.S. Air Force A-10 Warthogs flying in formation. Well, I knew immediately that this could not be the case for many, many reasons that I'll gloss over here. But I toyed with him for a little bit, and I asked him, he described how he had seen five A-10 Warthogs in very tight formation, flying at night, with their landing gears down, and I said, well, why didn't you hear them? You've already reported that this event was silent. And there was a long pause, and he said, well, they had their power off. And I toyed with him like playing a large fish on light tackle for a long time. And the bottom line was that he was attempting to get me to believe something that clearly not only was not true, but could not be true. What he didn't know is that I hold a commercial rating, a rating as a commercial pilot. Mm-hmm. I've served as a flight instructor in my past. And I am somewhat familiar with the A-10, what it looks like, what its systems are, how they operate, and so on and so forth. And I pointed out to him that no pilot in his right mind would fly in tight formation at night with his lights off, with his landing gear down, and with power reduced to zero so that the engines could not be heard even from 1,000 feet below. And he quickly realized that he had made some very egregious technical flaws in his description of the event. But that's a lot of words to say I toyed with him to get out of him as much information as I could, hoping that I could somehow learn why he was trying to mislead me, why he was trying to make me believe that the Phoenix Lights event was caused by four Air Force aircraft flying in tight formation over Mesa, Arizona. It's just not possible. So, other times, as I mentioned earlier, I will get very cross with the people, particularly those young people who call 10, 15, 25 times in a row and shout obscenities at me.
Yeah, you don't need that kind of grief. Exactly. Are you, now, I saw on your website you were thinking of putting their phone numbers up. Repeat offenders would have their phone numbers posted. Is that something you're considering doing?
Well, we have to stop it somehow.
Yeah, that might be a good way about going about doing that.
They are forcing me into a corner, and frankly, I will not allow the National UFO Reporting Center to be backed into a corner and crushed like a beetle under the heel of a jackboot without a fight. And if people don't think I'm capable of doing something really evil to them, they should reconsider.
Yeah.
Because I go on radio programs very, very frequently. Some of those programs are large programs with tens of millions of listeners. I think I have bigger guns than these young people who call and hoax me.
That's for sure. Now, what do you think, what caused the number for the UFO Reporting Center to become so prevalent all of a sudden? I mean, because the cell phones, I've seen kids with cell phones for like the last four or five years about, approximately. But it sounds like this thing has just sort of started in the last year or so.
Yeah.
Was that a result of your appearance on the ABC UFO special where like millions of people saw you, or just that you're on the radio all the time, or is there something else that sort of like got the word out on the UFO Reporting Center?
Yeah, I can only guess at what the answer or explanation might be for that. I simply don't know.
Yeah.
I think it may be the case that now that many people have gotten cell phones, they've learned how to use them, they've learned what they can do with them. Combine that with the fact that these younger generations are not really being carefully raised. They don't have a sense of good manners or consideration for other people or any of that.
Yeah.
And this is a very unsavory combination of events that leads to the problem I'm looking at. So I can only guess, but somehow we have to change it.
Yeah. And to sort of segue that to us, a question that's sort of been coming up a lot with my guests this season on the show is, on the other end of that spectrum, where do you think the young people are? How come you think they're not really gravitating toward ufology as a science like they were in the 60s, 70s, and like when you got involved in ufology? I'm young for the field. I'm only 27 at this point, so you know I'm one of the younger generation of the people in ufology. But I'm pretty lonely here as as one of the younger generation. Why do you think there isn't more young people in ufology, and how can we get them interested? Yeah.
Well, let me compliment you for not only having developed a serious-minded interest in ufology, but having founded a radio program that allows people like me to get the word out and share with our fellow citizens what appears to be going on. I think it's very, very important information. In fact, if it's true, it is the greatest scientific discovery in the history of man's science. Mm-hmm. We are not alone in this galaxy. But I'm not sure that young people aren't interested in this field. In fact, my suspicion is they're very interested in it. The problem may be with the press and with the entertainment and advertising industries, which more often than not don't address the issue in a serious-minded fashion. In fact, I would estimate, if I had to guess, I would say that everything the American people hear or see or experience or encounter about the UFO phenomenon is almost certainly dead wrong, somewhere between 90 and 99%, let me say. When I make that statement, I have in mind things like Saturday morning cartoons. I don't know if you've looked at children's cartoons on the television recently, but more often than not, they're racing around with aliens and spaceships and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
The whole cartoon industry is dominated by ufology, the concept of aliens coming to Earth. Also, there are things like the advertisements during the Super Bowl, and you name it.
Yeah.
There are many UFO-themed events in our society. Unfortunately, none of that has any bearing on the work I do. I am a scientist. I'm trained as a scientist. I'm an objective thinker by nature, and I try to limit myself to evidence and that information which I can corroborate and duplicate and so on. That is the information that is so terribly important to the American people.
Yeah. Now, moving on to specific sort of cases, do you have, now before we get into the Todd Sees case, because I have that as a separate bullet point here,
before
we get to that, do you have, I don't want to say a favorite, but a best case or one that you think is like the cream of the crop as far as UFO cases that you can think of right now?
Oh boy, there are a bunch of them.
I'm sure. Yeah, you sent me probably 2 dozen at least. I didn't know which one to pick, so I figured I'd defer to you on that.
Well, let me just tick off a few of what I consider to be the most interesting in the sense that they have the best documentation of all.
Yeah.
The biggest one, of course, is the one I alluded to already, the Phoenix Lights case, March 1997. The bottom line is 5 objects, each of which was, we estimate, the size of a major international airport, loitered over Phoenix and surrounding communities out to several hundred miles from Phoenix for probably upwards of 90 minutes. They were intercepted by the U.S. Air Force, which lied to the American people about this incident. And it was very, very dramatic. And there were many things that occurred that night that I am not even alluding to here. We have information from inside Luke Air Force Base as to what happened there that night. And there is no doubt in my mind but what they intercepted, at least one of these objects. And the interesting thing about that case is it was the same night that President Clinton, who was staying down in Florida at the time, injured his knee. We also have some evidence that a Defense Condition 3 was declared that night. It is intriguing to consider whether it might have been declared as a result of the Phoenix Lights event and whether the President of the United States might have injured his knee, if in fact that injury took place at all, in the course of his being evacuated
yeah.
to a military safe area in response to a UFO event.
Yeah.
Well, there are many other cases. I think the sighting by 8 police departments of a huge triangle over St. Clair County, Illinois,
mm-hmm.
this was January 5th, the year 2000, was a very dramatic, very well-documented case. In fact, there's a very nice website maintained by a gentleman whose name is Daryl Barker, works for, I think, St. Louis University, the law department, or Washington U, I'm not sure which, in which he documents that case magnificently well. It was a very dramatic case, and we have evidence that a UFO jumped somewhere between 8 and 20 miles, is our estimate, in under 5 seconds from
wow.
a dead stop to a dead stop.
Wow.
This is not swamp gas. This is not crash dummies. This is not weather balloons or such nonsense that skeptobunkers frequently cite have for decades. Another case that I find particularly interesting was the abduction of an elk out of the Washington State Forest in front of 14 witnesses, forestry workers. They were working on the side of a hill, planting trees. This was Thursday, 1 or 2 minutes before noon. It was February 25th, 1999. 14 forestry workers were just about to break for lunch when their supervisor saw an object approaching their location generally, following the contour of the tops of fir trees in the area. Long story short, that object went right towards a herd of elk that had been feeding below these workers. They'd watched them all morning long while they were planting seedlings. And that object, probably no bigger than a couch, a divan in your living room, went right up to one of the elk and lifted it off the ground and flew off with it.
Whew.
That happened February 25th, 1999. The reports are on our website at ufocenter.com. Another case that comes to mind, very, very dramatic, and this involved both the FAA and the U.S. Air Force. It occurred in, I believe, October of 2000, late October, as I recall. It happened to a group of 4 men who were at a remote hunting camp up in northern Idaho, and one of the men went out of their camper to get food out of a storage bunker or storage container in his pickup.
Mm-hmm.
What he saw, and he was a very experienced businessman, a pilot, he was a hunter, an outdoorsman, a hiker, and so on. Very little alarmed this guy. But as he stepped up on the rear wheel of his pickup truck, the flashlight that he was carrying with him, it was about 9 o'clock at night, swept across the night sky above his head, and it illuminated something above him. He looked up, and what he saw alarmed him so profoundly that he fell to the ground and started screaming for the other his friends and his brother to come out of the camper and look at what he was looking at.
Wow.
They came out of the camper just in time to see this huge black triangular craft that had been hovering over their camp, apparently, suddenly turn on all of its lights. It had been hovering there motionless,
mm-hmm.
apparently, for some period of time. Turned on its lights and slowly, very slowly, started moving over the camp they were in towards a range of mountains to the east. And when it got to the mountains, it tipped its nose up slightly and slowly worked its way up the side of this mountain range and went over the tops of the mountains to the east of the camp. Well, these 4 men sat there talking about what they had seen, wondering what in heaven's name they just experienced. The 2 brothers decided after a couple hours that they were not going to spend the night at that camp after
yeah.
what they had experienced and seen. So they loaded their deer rifles, they got in their pickup, and they drove for well over an hour to the nearest town, and they spent the night in a motel room. The next morning, they drove out to the Federal Aviation Administration offices, reported what they had experienced the night before, and within 25 or 30 minutes, I was told, 2 F-16s, U.S. Air Force F-16s out of Utah, they believe they were, went streaking over the camp at very low altitude with their afterburners on. So apparently the FAA had reported this event to the Air Force, and the hunters had GPS, handheld GPS units. So they gave exact coordinates to the FAA, and presumably that information allowed the U.S. Air Force to scramble very suddenly and fly directly over the camp. That was a very dramatic sighting.
Yeah, that sounds that's amazing. And this sort of popped a question into my head here. What do you make of the black triangle phenomenon? Because that seems to have become a big big portion of ufology in the last 10 years or so. And I'm sure you get like I just heard. You know, obviously, you get a lot of black triangle cases. What do you think is behind this the black triangle phenomenon?
Yeah, Tim, I have absolutely no idea. But I do not believe it's the U.S. military,
yeah,
as many people have suggested. Many people have taken our data and said, oh, the data from the National UFO Reporting Center show clearly, they assure us, that such and such is taking place. Well, I collected the data.
Yeah.
There's probably nobody who's more familiar with it than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see those trends. And moreover, I think it's significant that the people who are making claims for our data have never contacted me to discuss it, to find out more about the data that will allow them to tighten up their conclusions. But the black triangles are a reality. There's no doubt about it. I don't believe that they are U.S. military or they come from the military. They clearly, without any doubt whatsoever, are not aerodynamic devices. That is, they seem to have wings, but they don't need those wings for generating an aerodynamic lift to suspend them above the ground. They're flying through some other means or some other technology. What they are, I have no idea. None whatsoever.
Would you say there's been an upswing in those type reports over the course of the last 20, 30 years or something like that? Because I never really started hearing about them until like the last few years in my back research. I don't really hear too much about the black triangles.
Yeah, I think that's a correct statement. I have no idea where they come from, but it does seem that the reports of black triangles have become more frequent in, let's say, over the last decade than was the case in the 60s or 70s when what were being reported principally were disc-shaped objects. What the significance of that might be, I have no idea.
Yeah, it could be anything. There's a host of different explanations for that sort of thing.
Yeah.